forget frequently asked questions.
Common sense, common knowledge, or Google.
How about advice from a real genius? 95% of people in any profession are good enough to be qualified and licensed. 5%
go above and beyond.
They become very good at what they do, but only
0.1%.
are real geniuses. Richard Jacobs has made it his life's mission to find them for you. He hunts down and interviews geniuses in every field. Sleep science, cancer, stem cells, ketogenic diets, and more. Here come the geniuses. This is the Finding Genius Podcast
with Richard Jacobs.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Finding Genius Podcast. My guest is Stephen Cornett. He's the founder of Nature's Always Right, which I like that title already, tend to agree with it. So we're going to talk about his work with farming, homesteading, raising chickens, and all that good stuff. He's got a YouTube channel, which I'll ask him about. We'll get into it. So welcome, Stephen.
Thanks, Richard. Thank you for having me. Excited to talk to you about my favorite subject.
Yeah, well, tell me a bit about your background. How did you get into, you know, agriculture, raising chickens, and all that stuff you do?
Well, I got into it in the summer of 2011. I graduated with a business degree from San Diego State University. I grew up in San Diego, California. And after college, just kind of was disillusioned with the idea of just working for a company and, you know, doing the same old rigmarole. I kind of wanted to have a more exciting life. And, you know, different things went on for the first couple years after college. And eventually found farming through my best friend, Jared Smith. He started growing a little backyard garden. And, you know, growing up, my mom had a garden with blueberries and this and that. But I was never that interested because I didn't want to work outside and sweat. But
I agree. That's too. That stopped me. Yeah.
Yeah. And my friend started doing that and, you know, started learning more and more about health, food system. You know, there's an old documentary called Food Inc. I'm sure you can still see today, but, you know, really describes, you know, what went on with the food industry in America, how animals are raised, how vegetables are raised, what's done to the soil, all the chemicals used. And, you know, ultimately we realized that growing your own food, you can actually grow your own medicine. Because if your body has all the nutrients that it needs, the probiotics that it needs, then your body can actually, you know, do most of the healing itself. And a lot of these drugs that are prescribed to people and pharmaceuticals, this is all unnecessary if your body's given the right nutrition. So we went down that path and I helped him start like an acre and a half market garden. And a market garden is vegetables that are, you know, high turnover rate, like lettuce, carrots, beets, kale, chard, potatoes, all sorts of stuff like that. Fast forward a couple of years later, and then I started my own market garden in Lemon Grove, California. And I did that in a suburban area, all on leased land. So I didn't own any of it, but I found neighbors, and including the house that I was renting at, they had a third of an acre backyard. And these people allowed me to build gardens in their backyards, grow food, and then sold at the farmer's market in San Diego and La Mesa.
Okay. Where did you see your focus starting to go? What kinds of things about gardening really interested you that you got good at?
Well, just it's always changing. It's always new. It's never the same thing. There's always new skills that you can learn when it comes to growing food, new techniques. I got really into creating my own soil, my own compost, my own inputs. Like, you know, I got into Korean natural farming, Jadam, low-cost organic farming. These are different techniques that allow you to essentially make all of your own fertilizers, your own inoculants, your own pesticides. And that's kind of my main thing that I guess I fell in love with. And you know, just trying to help people learn how to do this themselves. So that I started my YouTube channel when I started my second farm in Lemon Grove, my own market garden. And, you know, the whole idea was I really thought that, you know, if we can get as many people doing this as possible, it could really change the culture of the United States or, you know, other people around the world, change their health. You know, I'm trying to get as many people to grow their own food as possible because I just feel like it's so valuable for your mental health, your physical health, and of course, the food that you eat. And once you've tried your first homegrown tomato or carrot, it's kind of a mind-blowing experience because, you know, in your first year gardening, you don't know anything, but you try this vegetable and it's just like, wow, the flavor in this is so much better than anything I've had at the store. What is going on here? How is this possible? How can I grow something that tastes better than a quote-unquote professional farmer? And that's kind of what leads you down to finding out, how do they grow food at scale? And at scale, everything's more like a factory. I'm sure most people have heard the term factory farming. Well, if you do anything at large scale, the quality diminishes substantially. You know, they're only caring about the profit at the end of the day. So whatever they can do to lower their costs, that's what they're going to do. But if you're growing your own food, and most people who grow their own food want to do it organically, you're able to use the best nutrients and really put a lot of care into the food that you grow. And it really shows in the flavor of the food that you grow.
I was just telling another person I interviewed, I've had, you know, the grocery store, like hydroponic strawberries and things like that. And they look good, but they're just like bags of water. They don't really taste like much. And,
right.
You know, has anyone studied the nutritional differences between hydroponically grown stuff and soil grown stuff? Is it vast? And what's missing? What's different?
Yeah, I would say so. So, you know, God designed everything to be grown in the soil, in my opinion. Can you do it with hydroponics? Absolutely. But what I would relate hydroponics to is, you know, if you've ever been in an ICU in a hospital, people are hooked up to all these fluid bags. They've got a feed tube that goes down into their stomach and they're fed nutrients through that. And they keep living. You know, they can pump their blood for them. It can do all this. But are they thriving? Are they healthy? No. And that's kind of how I see conventional farming, whether it's hydroponic or it's conventional large-scale ag where they're feeding these salt-based chemical fertilizers. They're giving the plants enough nutrients that they can turn into their final form, be large, but they're massively lacking in micronutrients. And this is something that's been talked about for decades now, that our soils have been depleted of micronutrients. And one of the big reasons for that is because the biology is lacking in the soil. It's all dead because they're tilling the ground and destroying all the fungal networks, the microbes, the earthworms, and then dumping chemicals that then further destroy biology. And plants actually get their nutrients from relationships with fungi and bacteria. It's not just that they just can uptake straight up nutrients. I mean, they can if you give them soluble nutrients. That's how it's done in hydroponics.
Nitrogen fixation is a big one, you know, for instance.
Yes, that is. Yeah, that's one of many, many things. I mean, there's so many nutrients that we haven't even discovered yet. I mean, I think vitamin K was discovered in the 90s, I want to say. So we don't actually know everything that's in our food. I know we like to assume that we do, but so there's what's it called? The Bio-Nutrient Association, another word in there I'm forgetting, but they're studying and trying to come up with devices actually that you'd be able to measure the nutrition in your food with like a light or a spectrometer. So there's technologies being developed right now so that we could like go to a grocery store, a farmer's market, and actually scan the food. And
that would be very, very useful. Yes. Or you could, you know, or if you buy something, if you're able to jab in, you know, something into the middle and get a real-time sample, you know, pesticide load, that kind of stuff would be very, very important.
Yeah, that would be amazing. And, you know, that is on the horizon. There's people working on that to try to get that done, because I think that would really change the food industry. Because currently, when you go into a grocery store, and just from talking to a lot of Americans, whether they were my customers or just people I know, cost is the major, major thing. And I'm sure everybody's seen the cost of food has gone up substantially. So most people are just thinking about the cost of food. They're not necessarily thinking about the nutrition that's in their food. But to me, the nutrition is the number one value factor that should be determined into the price that we're paying at the grocery store.
So what are you trying to grow things in such a way hydroponically as to replace the nutrients that are needed, you know, to have better products? Like what is the main focus of your work nowadays? What are you trying to do?
Completely soil-based. So everything I do is in the soil. I've gotten, since San Diego, I did my farm there for 4 years, and then I moved to Tennessee. And I've been here almost 4 years, and I live on 16 acres, and I have a big garden and an orchard, and I've got sheep, chickens. I also raise pigs as well.
Wow.
So I got really into raising my own meat. So that was kind of the next
step
of
the
journey.
Let's start with pigs. Maybe tell me some of the nuances, the good, the bad, the ugly.
Yeah. So pigs are very interesting because they're typically thought of as an unclean or dirty animal. But what I found out is they are actually, because they're so intelligent, they never sleep where they poop or pee. Whereas my sheep, one of the big issues with them is they will kind of, they'll sit in their poop if you're not moving them. And the poop contains parasites that will get into them and could kill them if the parasite load gets too large. So one of the big factors with this is all regenerative agriculture. So these are techniques that improve the land, the amount of carbon in the soil, which improves the health of the soil. This is all done by rotating animals on pasture land in an efficient and cost-effective way, but it also improves the land. So with my pigs, I raise them in the woods, and you can use electric netting. And this is a big way that's used to control animals today in the modern world. It's all electric so that you can continue to move them into these new paddocks very inexpensively, but they're always on new ground. And so the pigs are able to dig up things in the ground, like, you know, get bugs, get nuts. I feed them a non-GMO grain and corn and soy free. That's another big thing with omnivorous animals like chickens and pigs, is feeding no corn, no soy. That just
looks not even a small amount's no good for them.
Before we continue, I've been personally funding the Finding Genius podcast for 4.5 years now, which has led to 2,700 plus interviews of clinicians, researchers, scientists, CEOs, and other amazing people who are working to advance science and improve our lives and our world. Even though this podcast gets 100,000 plus downloads a month, we need your help to reach hundreds of thousands more worldwide. Please visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click on Support Us. We have 3 levels of membership, from $10 to $49 a month, including perks such as the ability to see ahead in our interview calendar and ask questions of upcoming guests, transcripts of podcasts you're interested in, the ability to request specific topics or guests, and more. Visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click Support Us today. Now, back to the show.
You can do it. I would definitely not feed soy, but one of the reasons to avoid, there's many reasons to avoid corn and soy, both in the human diet and the animal diet, is because those are two crops that are insanely GMO'd, and they're GMO'd to not die when they're sprayed with Roundup or glyphosate. I mean, this is an herbicide that created by Monsanto, which I'm sure some of your listeners have heard of that name. Bayer bought them out because they were sued for billions of dollars. They caused Hodgkin's lymphoma in the court case, and they were found guilty. But anyways, those are still sprayed till this day by that herbicide, among other things. And that's one of the reasons to not eat those foods. But the other reason would be that it increases the amount of omega-6 fatty acids. And when the ratio of omega-3, 6, and 9 are kind of out of whack, and you have way higher omega-6, that can cause a lot of inflammation in the body. And that's a more modern nutritional idea, but it's been studied and proven that that's what's going on. So a lot of our foods today, they have canola oil or soybean oil or sunflower oil, and those are massively off the charts in omega-6, like at least 40-1 compared to omega-3. So those are things I recommend getting out of the diet of humans and animals.
Okay, well, that makes sense. But what have you found out is an ideal diet for pigs? Like, I've heard with chickens, you know, black soldier flies or, you know, scraps from the crops that you harvested, they could eat almost anything, like garbage dumpsters, I guess, but it's not garbage. But what do pigs eat, and what have you found is a good diet for them?
Yeah, pigs can eat a lot more things than even chickens. You can definitely feed them almost anything. And, you know, the grain diet, the whole reason we do that is it fattens them up quickly, or you can raise them out to market weight more quickly. But you can also ferment other things for them, like grasses and, you know, if you had access to restaurant waste and things like this. Soldier fly also are great for pigs. Soldier fly is an amazing thing. I wish that we would utilize that in a bigger way, because we're dumping millions or billions of pounds of food into the waste dump to just degrade and turn into methane and off gas, when we could be processing all that, turning it into insects and feeding it to chickens and pigs. And we wouldn't have to grow as much grain for those animals if we were doing that. But, you know, that's a lot easier said than done.
What about the major inputs to switching back to soil for a minute? Nitrogen, you know, I've heard if you have the right cover crops, not only will it keep soil temperature down, moisture in, but also they can, you know, fix the nitrogen in between growing the other stuff they don't want. But what about phosphorus, you know, potassium, you know, the other parts of NPK come from, so you don't have to buy fertilizer?
There's all sorts of cover crop mixes that can help, you know, fix those nutrients into the soil. But ultimately, animals, they're going to provide a lot of NPK. And if you're rotating them well, then the pasture land that they're on will get better every single year. And I've seen it on, you know, dozens of people's farm, both in person and, you know, on video as well. So, you know, there's other ways to do it too, like the Jadam organic farming methods that I mentioned. You can just take whatever crops that you have, like, you know, if you have a bunch of leftover hay or grass or animal manure or corn stalk, dead fish, you could put any of that stuff, you put it in a barrel and ferment it in the barrel with water and leaf mold soil. The leaf mold soil, it's an inoculant. So you're adding some good microbes in there to help ferment it. And this is an anaerobic fermentation. You know, you could let it sit anywhere from 3 months to indefinitely. And all of the nutrients in whatever you put in there will become water soluble. You dilute that heavily, and then you could water that out onto your fields or into your garden bed. And that can be essentially a free liquid fertilizer. And those methods are some of the most interesting and cost-effective I've ever seen.
How much are you able to reduce or eliminate, you know, hopefully eliminate the need for fertilizer? Have you been able to, you know, on a large scale, a significant scale, eliminate the need for it, or do you still have to buy it?
I personally don't use fertilizer. I make compost from my animals. And like I said, I make the liquid fertilizers. And there's a lot of other things that I make as well in terms of minerals and all this stuff. So I've never used fertilizer here.
It's on amazing.
This farm. But, you know, this is small scale. At larger scale, it's 1,000 acres. You know, there's a reason why they use these salt fertilizers. All the machines are set up for it. And it is, you know, it's cost effective. But in recent times, the cost of it has gone up so much. So I do believe there's ways that we could scale up some of these like naturally made methods. But, you know, that's something I'd love to work on with a more larger scale farmer someday. But, you know, we need to test it and try it.
You add the scale, you know, let's say I said, all right, I want you to run a 50-acre, 100-acre plot. How long would it take? Could you generate enough compost? Could you run it without external fertilizer? And how long would it take you?
Well, there's multiple ways that you could kind of approach that. Like, you know, making a lot of compost is not, if you have the inputs to create it, like say you could get tons of free wood chips and you had tons of other green high nitrogen material like manures, and you had access to that and you have the machines to create it, then yeah, you know, it's a bit more feasible. But at 100 acres, that's a lot of compost. And this is where liquid fertilizers, I think, are more suited for that, because also the large farming implements are set up for liquid nutrient distribution. So, but you could absolutely do like lots of farmers out here for their pasture, that's like 100 acres. They'll get a lot of chicken manure from the local chicken houses, and then they have manure spreaders that they run out and dump all that onto the ground. So there's lots of ways to reuse and recycle these things out here. But, you know, cover crops and rotating animals, that's another way where you don't have to use any fertilizers. The animal is the fertilizer. The sun and the rain grow the grass. And if you're rotating them correctly, you're not going to damage the grasses, that they're actually going to get stronger and better every single year using cover crops, letting them mow that down. And then the final way would be to inoculate your fields with beneficial bacteria and fungi, and they will actually unlock a lot of the nutrients in the ground. So that's one reason there's a lot of nutrients lacking in soil, is because the right microbes are not there to break everything down. And
how do you cultivate those and create, you know, liquid slurries of them that you can get on the fields? Like what do you do to create them? Do they just come naturally as a byproduct of compost?
Yes. Yeah. Compost is one way to do it. You know, worm castings. And what you can do is create teas from these products. It's a way to expand the population of these microbes. So you can just, you know, you could get like 1,000-gallon tank even and brew up a huge batch of compost tea, worm tea. There's other techniques like Korean natural farming where you make really fancy fermented compost that is incredibly microbially diverse, and then you can also let that sit in water. A lot of this requires water to do at scale, because to get enough material to spread out on the ground is just, it's not as cost effective and it's more difficult. So, but yeah, that's
you got to do rain. Like probably a big thing you have to do is rainwater collection to use as feedstock for all this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, a lot of, you know, anybody who's got 100 acres, they've got a barn somewhere, so you could collect 10,000 gallons of water pretty easily. Or they have wells, so that's how I recommend.
If you don't mind, let's talk about compost a little bit. I haven't had too much luck finding people that are really knowledgeable about it. What are some of the elements that make composting successful or not? Like, you know, I've seen some with like this mold that forms in the pile, and you know, like what did I do wrong? So what are some basic elements?
Well, there's four components to compost. You need carbon, which is your browns, nitrogen, which is your greens. You need water, moisture, and then you need the actual microbes in order for them to process it. The actual heat that is created from compost is from the microbes living their lives through, you know, billions of generations extremely quickly. So
they're living their best lives.
They definitely are. They're in, like, you know, as you can think of them as these, there's a bunch of giant metropolis, New York City is happening every 60 seconds, you know, going on inside of the compost pile. So, you know, a basic formula that you can do is like 60% carbon and then 30% nitrogen, so it could be, the carbon would be thing be brown. So straw, it could be leaves, it could be wood chips, dried grasses, a bunch of cardboard that you've mulched. And then greens with high nitrogen things would be grasses, anything that's green that still has green that's plant material. So your garden scraps, grasses, manure, obviously. So it's really nice if you can do 10% of a manure or a really high nitrogen material, and then 30% just, you know, veggie scraps and stuff like that. And then you need to add the correct amount of moisture. So you would mix all that up evenly, the carbon and the nitrogen. You want to make sure that it's well mixed so that the microbes have access to the carbon and the nitrogen at the same time. And that would help.
In a compost pile in the center, wouldn't you get periods of anaerobic activity and then aerobic and anaerobic and aerobic? Wouldn't it go back and forth? And how does that create, like, depending on how often you mix the compost pile and the surface area to volume ratio, is there any point in tweaking that, you know, aerobic, non-aerobic activity on and off to make different composts?
Yeah, I mean, your normal hot compost pile is one that you're going to want to keep aerobic. And, you know, you can accomplish that just by turning the pile and making sure that it's not too wet. The amount of moisture that you're looking for in a compost pile would be like if you took a sponge and you wrung it out, and then you squeezed it again and just a couple drops were dripping out. Just, you know, just enough moisture so that would happen. That would be your ideal amount of moisture. And, you know, if it gets too wet, you could always spread apart the pile, add a tiny bit more carbon, then pile it back up. You know, turn your compost pile, you know, once a week if you can. But if you're lazy like me, sometimes I don't want to mess with it. So I'll just build a huge compost pile, get the right moisture, which takes a little bit of experience, but you can figure that out. And then I just let it sit. I'd sit there for 3 months, maybe turn it once or twice, and that's it. And then I just go ahead and use it. But
what do you notice the difference between, you know, periodically turned versus rarely turned?
It just takes longer if you don't turn it. So if you wanted to make compost even quicker, turning it can really help accomplish that, especially as you're learning and maybe you didn't get the ratios exactly right of the browns to greens. That will help keep it healthier and break down more quickly.
Is there any point in having a continuously turned or a automated system that turns it, if you could even do such a thing, you know, multiple times a day?
Well, there's two things you could look into. One is called an aerated static pile. So people will put in these like big PVC pipes and then use an air blower and blow air underneath the compost pile. And it's vented so that the air goes up into the pile and you can create compost extremely quickly. You can also do just a static pile, but it's aerated by just pipes. You can just shove a bunch of pipes with holes in them into the compost pile, and that creates a little bit of air gap in there, allows more air. And there's something very famous called the Johnson-Suh bioreactor. If you look that up online, you'll see a bazillion videos and articles about that. But that's like a great design that makes compost really quickly, keeps it aerobic, and then it doesn't really require you to do any turning because the oxygen is just is able to get in there because of the way they have the pipe set up inside of the pile.
What's some tips or tricks to put compost on your growing plants? Like what shouldn't you do? How much should you add? You know, how much should you compact it? Like what's some of the nuance there?
Well, we're coming into spring here, so now's a great time to add the compost to the soil. So, you know, before you've even planted, you know, maybe a month out before you plant, I think it's a good idea to get compost out there, because sometimes when you buy compost, depending on who's made it, it can still be a little bit hot, meaning it's still breaking down. So it still has a lot of heat in it, or the nitrogen could even be a bit high, which could cause your plants to burn. You know, that just depends on the individual compost maker, but get it out there and that'll allow, you know, maybe it'll rain once or twice. It'll drive down some of those nutrients and microbes into your garden soil, get things alive, waking up, and then plant into that. But, you know, through the season, I like to add, you know, say you have a one squash plant, I would add like one shovel full to that squash plant or that pepper plant. And then just with your hands, spread that out right around the base and a 1 foot diameter, and that's it. And, you know, water that in. If there's soils underneath need some more water, then, you know, water that in. And that's really all there is to it. Compost is the best thing that you could basically use. That's the fertilizer, that's the inoculant, it's got everything. So highly recommend that. Or worm castings are another great thing to get into as a home gardener. You can very simply create a worm bin system that is a very, very high quality fertilizer. You can run a worm bin for free, essentially. I mean, once you have it set up, the worms just grow forever and you're just throwing in scraps.
So how much, you know, a farm that is as
self-sustainable as possible, those least, you know, external inputs, how much better are the economics, or are they just different? They're not really any better.
Well, so if you're running a market garden like I was doing, it actually, based upon your labor costs, it makes more sense to just buy in really good compost because they're using machines, and it just makes more sense because, you know, if you can't be out there just turning compost piles and, you know, pay yourself $20 or $30 an hour, that it just won't work out. But if you do have access to machines, maybe you have, if you have land and you have a tractor and you have, an acre or half acre area where you can let wood chip come, like the arborist or tree companies come in and dump a bunch of wood chips for you, and you can just let those wood chips sit. Now it becomes cost effective because you're not having to use labor to do it. But where the money savings comes in is these techniques like Jadam organic farming, where you're making these liquid nutrients and you're not having to do anything because you just put it in a barrel and let it ferment. But you can lower your cost dramatically by doing that. And I'd recommend anybody to start experimenting with it. I don't really buy anything for my garden. When I started my garden, I did buy a bunch of compost to get it going. But now with the inputs that I make, the little bit of compost that I make, that's enough to keep everything going. And I'll do cover crops in my garden as well. That's another thing that's fantastic that it also helps.
Where are you located? And do you have, like, in the winter, do you have any frosts or freezes? You know, when do you have to stop growing?
I'm in Southeast Tennessee, and it's zone 7A. So yeah, about May is when I can throw in tomatoes and peppers and the summer fruiting stuff. I could start right now. I can start lettuce and radishes, kale, chard, even potatoes I could throw in the ground right now. But back in San Diego, I mean, that's an interesting place to grow because that's zone 10A and you basically don't get freezes there. So you can get away with a lot of stuff growing. I grew a tomato over a year long in San Diego, lived through the winter and kept going.
You can't do that. Do you have any greenhouses or like white peonies or anything special, or do you just grow outside? It's good enough.
In San Diego, I did. And I kind of just wanted to practice without greenhouses and with all the seasonality here. But I do need to set up one because, you know, starting your seeds, you can get it done a bit quicker and easier with a greenhouse. But yeah, starting in May, I have a super long season. I can go into December here. So
is there anything that's in demand that isn't normally grown where you're at in Tennessee that you're working on trying to grow?
In terms of vegetables, it's not as good of a market as San Diego, but I'd say salad mix is always like a big hit. That's something that farmers can make a lot of money at, and maybe even heads of lettuce. You can grow it very quickly. It's quick turnover. People were willing to pay a high price for it, especially when it's organic. But I would say pork, actually, this really high quality pork that I was describing, that's very in demand because it's impossible to find it. And once you've tried like real pork, not from a factory farm, I mean, there's just no going back. There's such a difference in the flavor and the texture. And, you know, I've had just a normal pork chop. You can't eat the fat, but the fat from the pigs that I raise or like my friends raise, it melts in your mouth. I mean, it's one of my most favorite pieces is like a pork chop with 50-50 muscle to fat on there. I mean, it's just incredible. I cook with the lard. I make lard from all the fat of the animal and use that for my cooking oil, and it's just a whole different experience.
Wow, you're using everything you can. It's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. It's that's part of the fun.
Like, I'm sure you've spoken to other market gardeners. How much more efficient are you economically at this point?
Well, market gardeners, what they compete on really is the quality, because nobody can match the quality of what a market gardener does. And I had many customers that told me, like, I can't go back to Costco and eating the salad mix there because yours lasts for 2 weeks in the fridge and there's so much more flavor and that so much more texture, But, and it is extremely efficient. It's amazing what you can grow on just a half acre or an acre. You're just really cramming in all the plants. As soon as a plant is finished growing, you have the next transplants ready to go in there immediately. And market gardeners will typically focus on crops that are 100 days or less. Many crops are just like 60 days or less, and you have a lot of garden beds, in-ground beds that you're constantly cycling out with a new crop. So it's extremely efficient. And if we had a million market gardeners that were providing local produce, I mean, it would be a pretty massive thing. But as I've found out in the last over a decade, there's not enough people who want to do it because it's a very difficult, it's not easy. Plus it's a lot of labor. You're going to spend at least 40 hours, more like 60 to 80 hours in the main part of the season. And there's just not enough people that want to work that hard, honestly. I wish I was hoping in the beginning that that would be the case. But where I've seen the biggest growth in this field is people that want to grow their own food at home, the homesteading movement. That's kind of where I've moved into, trying to help those people kind of with my farming and market gardening experience and that more efficient mindset to help people grow super nutrient dense food in a really efficient way.
Are you able to get all of your food from what you grow? Or do you still have to go and buy stuff? Or is your diet such that, you know, you like the occasional Starbucks or Twinkies or whatever? You got to go out and get it.
Yeah, like, you know, most of my stuff, like my meat, I'm either growing all of my meat, my chicken, my pork, my lamb. I have friends that raise cows. That's where I get beef. I have a friend that does raw milk. So that's where I get that. And then, you know, the veggies during the season, we just eat the veggies that we grow. Fruit is one thing that I don't have yet, because that takes quite a while to get fruit trees and all the berries and all that stuff going. So when I go to the store, it's getting staples like that. Fruit, rice, flour, things like that is mostly what I'm buying now at the store. And then in the winter, some vegetables, because I don't have a greenhouse, so I can't grow certain things in the dead of winter here.
Like, what percentage of all the food you eat comes from what you grow or from what other farmer friends grow?
Well, in the main season, it would be, I don't know, 80% probably of what I'm eating, 90%.
That's good.
But, you know, it takes time to get to that level. When I first moved here, I had to, you know, either buy from the Amish or the grocery store for quite a while until I had, you know, 2 years into this. Then I was like, okay, now I've got a really good food system going.
What about physically? Like, how do you feel about your health? You know, how are you feeling doing this and eating so much of your own stuff?
Fantastic. I mean, I never get sick. My body's in great condition. I'm 36 years old now, so I'm still young, but, you know.
I was going to joke and say you're 300 years old. You should tell me.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't know. I feel fantastic, full of energy.
Great. Excellent. So how can people learn more from you? Like, what's the name of your YouTube channel, and where can they go to learn more about what you're doing?
Well, they can go to my website, naturesalwaysright.com, Nature's with an S, or my YouTube channel is the same thing, Nature's Always Right, YouTube at Nature's Always Right, or any of the social medias. That's the same name everywhere, and they can see what I'm working on.
Well, excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a really good call.
Yes, sir. Thank you. It was a great time talking with you.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Finding Genius Podcast with Richard Jacobs. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe to the Finding Genius Podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And want to be smarter than everybody else? Become a premium member at FindingGeniusPodcast.com. This podcast is for information only. No advice of any kind is being given. Any action you take or don't take as a result of listening is your sole responsibility. Consult professionals when advice is needed.